word.
Antigone rouses herself. War is awful. Giving dragons to terrible people is awful. There's no good answer, Griff. I look into Sparker's doleful amber eye, blinking at me over that wretched muzzle, and ask, would it hurt? Antigone's face softens. Not if we use Drakthanasia, but I need to figure out how to get it. Seeming to sense my lingering horror, she jabs a finger at our dragons. At wings and fangs and talons, and a tonnage of weight behind them. I'm sure you've grown fond of them, Griff, but at the end of the day, they're weapons, attuned to the will of one lord who would not think twice before turning them on you. She says it so forcefully, it's like she thinks she's the only one who knows it. But she isn't. Maybe where she's from, but not on New Pythos. I yank my sleeve up. You think I don't know that? Antigone looks down at the scars where Nita's fangs left dents, and her eyes widen. I've been bitten and burned and gnawed on as many times as my lord gave the order. I've served as target practice in a pen, run in circles till I couldn't run more. I've seen my friends dropped, and then I had to scrub and feed and shovel the shit of the dragons that did it. Don't tell me what they can do. Antigone's eyes are bright, her breath fast. Good. I yank my sleeve back down. I may have too big a heart for the monsters, but I'm no fool, nor a coward. Get me the poison and I'll do it. Even as I see that I've satisfied her doubts, my own twinge. There is one dragon in the fleet I know would never hurt me, whose lord would never order it, and for them I would very well be both a coward and a fool. Already was a fool tonight, a happy, love-struck fool kissing him in the darkness. How could I ever do such a thing to Jephira, to Dilo?
20. Secrets Kept. Lee. Megara gives me the passphrase and the address of a pub on the border between Southside and Highmarket, managed by her uncle, for Kaur's and my inaugural meeting with the Passy. The Ministry's first official ruling on the group arrives earlier the same day. The decree, copied to the entire inner palace, will be printed in tomorrow's editions of the Gold Gazette and the People's Paper. The self-proclaimed Passy are enemies of the revolution. Association with the Passy is prohibited. Enemies of the revolution should be reported to the Ministry of Information for questioning and corrective action. I stare at the memo and think, I need to talk to Annie. The only thing I'm certain about the meeting I'm about to attend is that it will be illegal. And while I'm no longer committed to upholding the laws of this regime, violating them at this level of risk and behind Annie's back seems doubly foolhardy. I'm making my way down to the First Rider's office when I hear voices from the armory. Annie's with Powers. I just think maybe we should tell Holmes, Power is saying. If we tell him, he'll forbid it. You heard him. The Norsians are our enemy, just like their lords. This stays between us. I stand frozen outside the armory, picturing the conversation within. I've never heard Annie use that voice with anyone but me. Confiding and wry, the tone I associate with conversations we have alone. All right, says Power. It's also the first time I've ever heard Power not sound like an ass. I can hear gear thunking as it's being removed from hooks, ground uniforms being unfastened and stripped to the floor. From the sounds alone, I can picture it. I know what it's like, those moments alone in that armory with a patrol partner, undressing in front of them like neither of you is thinking about it, when you both are thinking about it. Annie conspiring with Power, undressing in front of Power. The funny thing about overhearing a betrayal is that it makes your own impulse to come clean evaporate. I turn on my heel and go find Cor. He's in the dark, empty solarium, just staring at the decree. "I'm still game if you are," I tell him. His face breaks into a wolfish grin, the more startling for its absence from his face for the past days. An hour later, we head out to an illegal meeting with the Passy together. Only as I'm making my way out of the palace in the dead of night with Cor do I wonder, what are Annie and Power keeping secret from Holmes? Who was it she wanted me to meet before Megara interrupted us? But as I wonder, and even as jealousy gnaws, I find I have no interest in discussing Annie's secret dealings with Cor. The Roper family's pub is called the Misanthrope, and the Passy's meeting takes place in one of the upper rooms around a table where about a dozen young people are gathered, the shutters drawn, and the candles in the centre glowing on the faces in the darkness. When Megara takes a seat at the head of the table, she tells them, "Well, it's finally happened. We're officially illegal." A cheer goes up like she's made a toast. Megara grins. She produces a basket, unclasps her gold wristband, and drops it in. "We are all equally deserving," she murmurs. It's a line from the most famous Damian philosopher, the one known in Deimos as the father of philosophy. One by one, as the basket goes round, every citizen surrenders their wristbands and repeats the phrase. There are no silver wristbands, most are iron or bronze, with Megara one of the only golds. But there are three silver and gold. Mine, Cor's, and taking one of the last chairs before the meeting begins, Lotus. "Dad's running late," he tells Megara. He nods at Cor and me, flicking back a coil of wiry hair as he scoots his chair in. "Welcome to the second revolution." Cor grins back like the party's starting. "Poets for the Passy," he says. "All right." Lotus lets out a bark of laughter. "Glad that decree didn't scare you off." Was this how it felt, the thrill of potential, when Atreus did this 10 years ago? A red-bearded man seated opposite me folds his arms. It's the same one, I realise, who pressed a cleaver to Power's throat the night of the Lyceum raid. "This who I think it is?" the man asks. Megara begins unrolling a scroll across the scarred table. "It is Lee, meet Jester, director of popular engagement." Lotus mutters with a hand over his mouth, "And street lord?" The door creaks open and the publican, Val Lazari, comes in alongside Lotus's father, Lo Tiran. The last time Tiran and I spoke, we were in the men's washroom, where he was attempting to interview me for an epic poetry commission about Palace Day, and it turns out he's enmeshed in a radical protest group. Unexpected. "Hello again, Leo," he says. "No talk of poetry today, I promise." There is a smile in his oddly flat voice. "Lee's fine," I answer, hearing the edge in mine. He and Megara's uncle take the final seats at the table. Tiran, slim, brown, and groomed with precision. Val Lazari filling out the remaining space with his considerable girth strained over a stained tunic. Like Megara, like Cor, Lazari has the olive skin of Damian ancestry and the rolling consonants of Southside. Despite his humble appearance, it's conspicuous from how the rest of the room attunes to him that Lazari is their leader. "Well done, Megara," he says, looking me and Cor over like we're fat game brought in from the hunt. "This is quite the coup." Megara smiles. She turns to me. "Lee, tell us what you were saying earlier." Many at the table are young enough to be Lyceum students. Megara's uncle and Lo Tiran are two of the oldest. Anna, Cor's class iron sister, is among the women present. I clear my throat. the inner palace, making decrees against you, means that you've got their attention. Use it. Let me write for you. I can elevate the rhetoric, make the Passy's leaflets something the Golds take seriously. Lazari's brow arches. Megara says, "Told you, uncle." Lotiran says, "We had a more direct path in mind for you, Lee." It seems I'm the only one confused. Kor and his sister have exchanged a smirking glance, and Lotus lifts his eyes with a sigh. "You're already on your way to being considered for Protector Designate, are you not?" Tiran prompts, like I'm a student, slow on the uptake. "Possibly the Gold's favored candidate?" Oh, that's why Megara was so eager to recruit me. I feel a sudden twinge of unease. "That's years from now. Atreus isn't planning to step down anytime soon." Tiran's and Lazari's eyes meet. Lazari says, "No, he's not planning to, you're right. But it can't hurt to play the long game. Begin securing your standing for when the time comes." "I wanted to push for constitutional reforms." "Good. You will be well placed to push for them as Atreus's successor." "Any reforms will require strong leadership," Tiran adds. "A voice people will listen to." That doesn't sound very democratic. The first time I discussed succession, it was with Annie, the only person even less interested in a Dragon Lord's son regaining power than I am. But only now do I realize the difference that made. Megara, the Golds, this room of people. Do they all just look at my face, see a storm scourge, and assume? I spent a childhood unlearning the belief that to be Dragonborn meant to deserve power. But now that my identity's in the open, it seems others are determined to assume it for me. Even though, in principle, I see the reason in Lazari's and Tiran's arguments, the easiest way to ensure these reforms is to take the reins. But I don't have Annie's steady gaze reassuring me, and her absence feels like a piece missing. I can do that. But I'd like to write, too." Lotiran's voice is dry and reedy. "That can be arranged, though you'll need to write under a pseudonym for now. In the meantime, you should begin attending events on the Janiculum and resume doing morale visits in the city. You'll want to develop a rapport on both sides of the river." I hear myself ask, like a haggling trader seeking one last add-on, "What about the raiding?" Megara sighs. Lazari, who has spread calloused hands on the table as if about to rise, pauses. "What about the raiding?" It's surprisingly difficult to face this publican down. "It might be counterproductive to your long game." Lazari looks unamused, as if I'd made a joke in poor taste. Megara answers for him quietly. "There is no long game if people don't eat, Lee." Jester the Street Lord snorts, like he's pretty sure he's looking at someone who has never been hungry a day in their life. Which is wrong, but also enough to stop the retort I'm about to make. Of course, I agree, but it's not that simple. Lazari glances at the window, drawn with blackout curtains. "Shall we save other plans for another night? The city is hungry, and we have bread to give them." What happens over the next hour feels like a strange inversion of daily duties as a guardian. Sacks of bread baked from stolen flour wait in the cellar, along with a hamper of green scarves. Lazari names streets, and members of the Passy claim them, taking a sack each and scarves to hide their faces. The shouting is cheerful, the Passy eager to set out into the night, to leave gifts of bread on the steps of the unsuspecting poor. Unlike ration card distribution as a guardian, this has the feeling of a noble effort, something the participants can feel proud to be part of, rather than guilty. But the problems with the scene niggle the back of my mind. The bread is made from stolen grain. The luck of those who will receive it stems from their streets being within a walk of the misanthrope, from living in the neighborhood of someone who dared rob a city granary. The metal stratification isn't fair, but neither is this haphazard redistribution. After we watch the passy vanish one by one into the night, Cor and I make our way back through the darkened streets to the palace. "Megara won't tell you this," Cor says, his voice low to keep from disturbing the sleeping city, "because she doesn't talk about it. But her mother was arrested by the re-education committee when she was 8, 9? Spent about a year in the vault. Megara was raised by Lazari. Even after, because rumor is her mum never really recovered. So I'm not the only one with personal grievances against Atreus's regime. The vault is the headquarters of the Ministry of Information and the printing press of the People's Paper. It's also where the re-education committee keeps political prisoners. What was her mother arrested for? Cor shakes his head. That, I don't know. The stars are bright overhead, the winter air fresh and crisp on our faces. I think they really believe in what they're doing, Cor says. I hear the desperation in his voice, to believe with them. I don't have the heart to point out that Atreus believes in what he's doing, too. Dora's invitations to parties on the Janiculum have accumulated, mostly unread, in my mailbox since the fate of the Fourth Order. I begin opening them, begin answering them, accepting every dinner party and salon invitation the Golds have to offer. I begin signing up for every morale visit the Ministry of Propaganda can throw at me. And I begin penning articles for the Passy's leaflets to pass to Megara Roper between classes. I tell myself that if I have the sort of face people follow and the sort of voice they listen to, I should use them. I need not let my father's gifts go to waste. I will use them to uproot his kind of elitism where it grows like weeds from this new regime, and fight for the justice that my family, and now Atreus, has denied them. I tell myself that I can use my father's gifts without becoming like him. The day the first article runs, Annie finds me in the refectory at breakfast, takes a seat across from me, and places two hands on the table. It has been over a week since the funeral for the fallen guardians. Over a week since we woke in the same bed and ended the day not speaking. I look past her at Power, watching us where he stands ladling 4 scoops of porridge, a Gold's full rations, into his bowl. Annie and I have each only taken an iron's worth. She and Power are both in flame suits, as if they just got off a night patrol. Annie's eyes are ringed with dark circles. The last few night shifts she's done have been with Power. She places the Passy's latest leaflet on the table between us. It's the first time I've seen the piece printed, and the sight of it sends a thrill of triumph through me that I know Annie can see flicker in my face. "There's a new voice from the Passy," Annie says, styling himself as the revolution's son, advocating a reinstitution of the People's Assembly. I take a bite of porridge. "And what do you think about it?" Annie folds her arms. "I think association with the Passy is illegal. I think I have a war with New Pythos to prepare for. I don't have time for opinion pieces." I open my mouth to argue with her, and something else comes out instead. "Then train with me." Train. Be ready for next time. As I wasn't for this time when it all went to hell. If I'm going to take action, there's no reason I can't take action on both fronts, in the city and for the war. Annie puffs out a breath, like this isn't what she expected and doesn't know where to blow her deflating frustration. Fine. As disinterested as both of us act about the proposition of sparring the dragons out us, Palor and Aayla turn giddy when they realize what we're about, wings twitching, snorting steam in the cold as we meet in the air over the Eyrie. Their excitement undermines somewhat the cold tone of Annie's follow-up question, asked at coasting height. This assembly, she asks, would putting it in place mean abolishing the metals system? So she did read it. Don't you think maybe it should be abolished? I've become so convinced of this over the last few weeks that it surprises me when Annie frowns. I don't know. People are born with different levels of intelligence and ability, aren't they? Damocles said, we're all equally deserving. Annie's nose wrinkles. Just because some old philosopher wrote it doesn't make it true. Anyway, what would happen to us? The metals test is how we got here. She gestures around us, at the dragons we ride, the arena below, and the palace complex surrounding it. Snow dusts them like an inverted frosted cake. It occurs to me with unexpected surprise how differently we must have experienced that test. I thought of it as a shortcut back to somewhere I belonged. But for Annie, it's been a ticket to something she never could have had otherwise. We'd still be guardians. We'd still have dragons. Annie's hand goes to Aayla's side, which she rubs slowly. I'm not sure that's where this line of thinking leads, she says. The Damians' philosophy led them to get rid of their dragons entirely. It's what they're known for, aside from their assemblies, equal voting rights, and advanced air defense technology. I spread my hands. Palor twitches beneath me on an unexpected gust, impatient to begin sparring. You don't think something has to change? People are getting unequal shares of food. People have always gotten unequal shares of food. Annie drops the reins entirely to rub her face with both hands. Her cheeks are flushed from the cold, her breath steaming. It's more that I'm not sure the Passy should be the ones in charge of changing things. Maybe they're getting on a better track. Maybe, Annie allows. Or maybe they're just going to keep making my life harder. She sounds so dismal, I don't know how to answer. I'm still not approved for rationing supervision. We haven't discussed Annie's reasoning, though I find it transparent enough. She doesn't trust me to enforce, not after the Lyceum sacking. But that means the brunt of concerns about civil unrest fall on her. I'm going to work it from the inside, I say. Talk to Dora. Talk to the Gold Advisory Council. Even in my own ears, it sounds desperately idealistic. Especially as I remember Megara's answer, there is no long game if people don't eat. Are you going to talk to Atreus? Annie asks. It hadn't even occurred to me. I don't have anything to say to Atreus. The silence stretches. Why would she think the man who ordered me dead, who authorized outlawing the Passy in their entirety, would be someone I'd try approaching with their agenda? Annie's bleak face is pinched, her eyes fixed on Aayla's horned neck. For the first time, an unpleasant alternative occurs to me. Are you going to talk to Atreus? I'd assumed Annie's silence as a friend. But for the first time, it occurs to me that if she really is opposed to what the Passy want, the Ministry's exhortation to report enemies of the revolution might be one she feels obliged to obey. Atreus would, in all likelihood, find what Annie has deduced about the Passy's membership very interesting, and the Ministry of Information even more so. If she wanted, Annie could land me in a cell in the vault for this article. Annie's face ripples as though the thought itself hurts her. I hope I don't have to. I draw Palor's reins up short at this answer, the wind buffeting my back, and he snorts in surprise. Annie lowers her visor. Her voice becomes muffled. We should stop having this conversation. Let's train. I think we're both relieved to be done talking. It's too cold to spark, and we have to stay low over the arena to avoid the rime ice that claws at higher altitudes at this time of year. But neither dragon minds the added challenge. I haven't been in the air since the Pythian expedition, and haven't sparred with anyone since before the duel with Julia. Despite my relief to be in the air again, I find myself gripping Palor's flanks tightly with my knees. You have to get over this. You're not going to sit on the sidelines the next time we face them. It goes fine, better than expected, for the first few bouts. We've broken a good sweat, and the dragons are warmed up, eager for contact charges. When Palor lands a hit and Annie grunts. And it happens again, like it did drilling with Chryssa. The darkness of the ash seems to spread across my vision. And all of a sudden, I can hear her. The memory explodes into Palor as a spillover that freezes us both. Annie's voice snaps me back. Do you want to stop? I can feel a churning in my stomach, horror at the memory so great. Self-loathing so acrid, it's manifesting as nausea. But I force myself to think of Max, of Orla, of Duck, of Ixion making Annie watch. No. We rein the dragons round, reset, and charge again. We only stop when the mid-morning bells ring. We both have class within the hour. We'll do it again tomorrow, Annie decides. And I can't tell if she's suggesting it as a friend or ordering it as a commander, but at any rate, it isn't a question, so I can't say no. And we do. Day by day, it gets easier. What doesn't get easier is talking to Annie. Not when I'm handing articles to Megara Roper in the back of lecture halls to turn and find Annie's eyes on us. Not when I watch her on her way to class alongside Power, noticing how, night after night, her patrols pair with his. Remembering that, not too long ago, I woke to a morning where I held her. But I've had years of sparring with Annie when we had nothing to say to each other. Years of silence as we kept each other's secrets. This is no different. She won't talk. She said she wouldn't. But I know that's not quite right. She said she hoped she wouldn't have to. Kor invites me home for midwinter. He doesn't invite Annie. Half a year ago, Duck invited her home for midsummer and she went. I walk in on her crying in an empty classroom, and when I ask if she's all right, she tells me that it's nothing. When I visit Chryssa in the infirmary and she asks for news from the city, I find myself unable to talk about the Passy or Annie at all. I deliver speeches at morale visits, author democratic manifestos under a pseudonym, and spend evening after evening on the Janiculum Hill, downing welcome wine and measuring the sentiment of the patricians like the temperature of water. Not that I've read it myself, but I heard the Passy have run a few good pieces recently, they tell each other. Bit more intellectual rigour, I heard. When significant glances pass my way at the moniker Revolution's Son, I nod and let them wander. When I ask Dora Mithridates for an audience before the next meeting of the Gold Advisory Council, she tells me that she'll see what she can do. And when I stand on the streets of my city performing the morale visits I've been trained by this regime to give, I look upon these faces, these metal wristbands, and I think, with a thrill of growing conviction, enough is enough. For now, I'll raise morale as this regime expects me to, but one day I will make a different kind of speech, and the people will be ready for it. I just wish I didn't feel like I was working behind Annie's back to get there. 3 days before midwinter break, Cor approaches me after class with a leaflet I didn't know the Passy had planned. It's a map of the city, headlined, Granary Locations of Kallipolis. Did you give... His face has drained of colour. Megara asked, he says. But I had no idea this was what they were planning with the information. He knows as well as I that this, unlike the think pieces I've been running about ideal best forms of government, is a printing that forebodes action. Megara's and Jester's kind of action. Raids and riots and violence. A message from Southside's daughter, the leaflet reads. The people deserve to know.
Annie. I haven't had persistent nightmares since I was a child. Now the dream I cannot escape, that finds me every night I'm not on the dunes with Griff, could hardly be called a nightmare, except that I wake from it every time feeling as if I've been cut open. In the dream, I look over the group lists for attack, and I realize I wrote Duck's name down for Lee's group after all. And then I realize, silly me, Duck stayed behind. He's alive. Duck's right around the corner, right there. I wake so full of hope that I'm drenched with sweat. And then, though I don't deserve it, though I am the last person who deserves it, I reach under the pillow and touch that bit of Duck's cuirass and wonder how many weeks and months and years it will take for me to forget his face as I've forgotten my mother's. I learned years ago the ways to keep my nightmares from waking others. Bury the sounds you can't stop yourself making in your pillow till the lack of air makes you dizzy and your tears cool. The old trick feels like a forgotten friend. Grief feels like a forgotten friend. A friend that visits me and smothers me at night. It is one of the times I'm doing the old trick when I hear sobbing that isn't my own, coming from a few beds down the row. Alexa is on night patrol. Krissa still in the infirmary. The only other guardian in the girls' dorm is Deirdre. And I'm not entirely sure, when I light the lamp and go to her, that she'll want me. Me, the commander responsible for that mission. The reason Max showed mercy to a lowborn rider who tore him apart. But when I wake her from her nightmare, she curls into my embrace and weeps. I'm sorry I woke you, she says. It was what I used to say to them, before I'd mastered the tricks. And I feel a swell of compassion deeper than words as I hold her. I'm strong enough to wipe my own tears and comfort someone else. The day the Passy release the map of the city granaries, I'm stationed in Cheapside, supervising ration distribution alongside Power. We stand shoulder to shoulder, watching the queue wind round the square, trampling the latest snowfall into a brown mush. Our dragons huddle on the perch mounted in the center of the square, their wings tight against their bodies to preserve warmth. I can't remember when it started seeming easier to pair with Power for patrols on the ground, as well as on the nights I go to Griff. Only that, at some point, it became less exhausting than any other option. I'm waking daily from nightmares about Duck, racing from classes I'm barely on top of to drill sessions in stuck silence with Lee. After that, on rounds, I'm tracking reports of the northern coast for signs of movement from Basilea and patrolling the city as unrest spikes, wave after predictable wave. In time with the Passy's publications. With so many other sources of pressure, it's become a relief to have a partner in on the secrets I'm keeping. As to what Power gets out of it, I'm not sure, since he looks as exhausted as I feel but never complains. He's adapted to our new dynamic with unfailing irony. So, he says, as if we're on a stroll in the park rather than on the edge of a square being glared at by starving citizens. What are your plans for midwinter? My plans for midwinter are to spend as little time as possible thinking about Duck. Or about his home, where I won't be. Or about Lee, who will be there with Cor. My stomach growls. Rations keep being tightened. Servings cut. I haven't eaten since last night. I'm going to that play at the Janiculum Theatre. In recognition of the exigencies of this winter, the traditional midwinter feast at the palace has been replaced by a grand opening of the revolutionary players' winter season. All ministry officials and senior lyceum students are invited. Drinks will be served, but no small foods. They learned from the lyceum raid. Power rolls his eyes. Doesn't count. That's mandatory for guardians. I seed. Library. I have to research the widowing for Garrison. That is the most pathetic midwinter plan I've ever heard, Antigone. These days, power can be relied upon to be civil about half the time. The other half, I don't have the energy to engage. This is old territory, anyway. Power's been making fun of my lack of family for as long as I can remember. Above us, on the perch, Eater attempts to make more room for himself. There's a scuffle of wings and a squawk, and Ayla kicks him off. Power scowls up at them. I realize I'm smiling. Just a little. Good girl. It was stolen! I swear to you, it was stolen, please! At the other end of the queue, voices rise from the distribution booth. I feel the familiar jolt of dread mixed with adrenaline.
I'm sorry, madam. If we've already marked your name off for the week.
I have children, please! This sort of incident has become more and more common as the winter sets in. Vocal outbursts of dissatisfaction have grown louder with each of the passies' speeches and leaflets, with the slogans they paint on walls decrying injustice. The guard facing off with the woman in the booth looks queasy. His glance darts in my and Power's direction. The eyes of every single class ion within earshot are on the woman who is crying. In these moments, it's my job to set sustainable precedent. Whether or not the woman is telling the truth isn't what matters. What matters is if a square full of people see someone get a second ration card on this argument. I jerk my chin no at the guard, then murmur in an undertone to Power. Follow her out of the square and give her a second card. Be discreet.
Saw you do that!
I look up. The woman, having been rebuffed by the guard, is making her way past us empty-handed. For a moment, I think she's talking about what I just said to Power. Maybe even intends a thank you. But then I see the fury in her expression. Her voice is full volume, almost shouting level, and she's glaring at me.
Saw you tell him no, you bitch!
One of the men standing in the queue nearby says,
That's all right, Sue. Just keep walking. There's dragons overhead.
The woman's eyes are like hard diamonds as spittle flies from her mouth.
What's it like to you people? Watching us beg with your bellies full of silver and gold rations? Everyone is equally deserving.
She doesn't want any trouble, the man in the queue tells me. Go, Susan.
The woman turns away from me, spewing curses. Power glances at me, double-checking the order. I nod, and he follows her, reaching into his pocket for a spare ration card, leaving me in the square, beneath the glares of Susan's friends in the queue, the stupid protest that I wanted to give her swirling in my head. My belly's full of iron rations just like hers, thanks to Rock's signage in the refectory. A scrap of paper blowing across the muddy square flutters against my boot. I flatten it with my heel and read the passy's latest. Granary locations of Callipolis. My stomach, already lurching with hunger, rolls over. When power returns, his expression has none of its usual mockery.
You all right?
I nod unsteadily, hold out the leaflet. Power looks down at it and swears.
This is a national security hazard, he says. All it would take is one Triarchist-loving fool to ship one of these leaflets north.
That's my thought, too.
What are Lee and Cor up to today?
He asks loudly. I fold my arms, feeling dizzy.
Don't. Lee doing another morale visit? Inspiring starving Callipolans with his soaring rhetoric?
That is, in fact, exactly what Lee's doing, a few blocks from here. Since our return from the Pythian expedition, he has agreed to do morale visits again. He talks about the war effort. He talks about tightening our belts for Callipolis. He talks about a brighter future. He doesn't talk about the subjects he writes about, as the revolution's son. But the same voice, the same optimism and vision shines through. I told him I didn't have time for his opinion piece. But afterward, when I read it, I saw Lee in it. Not the furious one who came back from the duel, the one I've known from the beginning, who loves so deeply and thinks so clearly and combines his love and thoughts into principles around which he orders his life, who sees past all the petty details to something greater and nobler even when it requires sacrifice. I knew his voice when I read it, and saw in his ideas about equality and assembly and democracy that old familiar beating heart, that love for someone he shouldn't love, the ability to recognize personhood in the most unlikely of places, where it had previously been denied. This Lee I loved. This Lee who was able to love me. Even after a childhood raised on the belief that I wasn't the kind of being worthy of it. I read his piece and thought, who am I, with all my mercenary considerations, to stand in the way of such beautiful hope? I give Power the only answer I can think of that he might understand. Maybe the people could use a little inspiration. Not much else to feel good about right now. Power's lip is curling as he looks at me.
Do you enjoy playing the stick to his carrot?
I lift my shoulders, hands deep in my uniform pockets. No, I don't enjoy playing the stick. But I know I'm good at it. And in my best moments, I don't resent Lee for standing on the other side when we once said we'd do it together. I don't blame him for being the inspiration that keeps his sight on the stars, where mine is trained on the horizon and the ground. In my best moments, I know that this Lee, who seems so bent on making my job harder, is the same Lee I've always found worthy and good. Those are my best moments. Right now isn't one of them. Power takes one last look at the leaflet, then crumples it. Another blows past our boots.
Annie, it's time we do something about this.
What? I ask hollowly, though of course I know. They're everywhere, I realize, looking around us. Leaflets blowing through the square, flopping wetly across sludge. None of the class ions dares touch them with the guardians present, but they're glancing at the papers curious. And I know that however thoroughly the city guard sweeps and confiscates, it won't be thorough enough. Aren't the think pieces enough? I want to ask Lee. Why must you make me choose? But he's not here to answer that.
Report them, Power says. Report her, at least. They need to find this press and shut it down.
The city guard has been searching for the Passy's rogue printing press, to no avail, for weeks. I look down at the leaflet. A message from Southside's daughter. I think of the way my stomach curdled when Megara sat beside Lee and smiled at me. I don't think I've ever despised a classmate as much as I did her in that moment. But jealousy and bitterness don't mean I want her interrogated or tortured. And that's what will happen if I turn her over to the ministry. We don't know.
We know enough.
This is when I butt up against the limitations of Power as a confidant. Because where Lee's idealism is exhausting, Power's eager pragmatism alarms me. Like it's a glimpse of the road I'm going down and I don't like where it leads. When this happens, the only thing I can think to keep waters rising past breath is that soon I'll have another meeting with Griff. With Griff, I don't have to question myself for doing my job. I teach him to read and plot revolution and go home warm with the knowledge that in this one part of my life, I don't have to weigh evils to be sure I'm doing the right thing. I just know. The dragons know too. One night, we look up and find Ayla taking Sparker's muzzle in her mouth. He's so much larger than her that she's had to lift up on her haunches to reach it, gnawing on it gently, like she might a bone. Sparker sits quite still. She's trying to remove it. Griff has frozen, his face awash with such emotion that it's difficult to look at. And then it occurs to me, looking at Ayla. She could get it off. She could fire on it, heat the metal. If she heated it enough, she could break it. Griff swallows. His pupils have dilated, a longing that isn't his flooding his features. It's warm enough, this close to the shore, and sheltered between dunes, that Ayla can still spark. She inhales experimentally, her mouth filling with the light of a summoned flame. But then Griff blinks and shakes his head, rubs at his jaw like he's feeling a phantom.
I can't. We'd get in trouble.
I can hear disappointment thick in his voice. I whistle to Ayla, and she releases Sparker's muzzle. Sparker whimpers, frustrated. Griff murmurs his name, and Sparker comes to him, barreling against him with characteristic force.
Not tonight, love.
He busies himself scratching Sparker's chin under the muzzle, half turned from me, like whatever he's feeling, he wants to keep private. I watch his turned back, pondering. The plan for a widowing waits on me and my research. But I realize now that there's another layer needed. When I bring the Drakthanasia, that's when Ayla should break Sparker's muzzle. That way he could break the other squire's muzzles when you go back, and you could do it all at once. Widow theirs and free yours. Griff's bent over Sparker, rubbing his belly while Sparker rolls in the sand.
Could be risky. If the Dragonborn noticed Sparker didn't have his muzzle, he says, might be better if you and Ayla came and did it. You speak a bit of Norish, don't you? My niece would be thrilled if you showed up. Most of the Norsians would be, to be honest.
Me? Why?
Griff snorts. Are you kidding? We've had to forbid the kids from pretending to be you.
But I swallow, hitting on the thing that needs to be circled to even talk about. There were Norsians in those strongholds that we attacked. Griff's nose wrinkles.
Pretty clear whose fault that was for anyone with half a brain. Point is, you're a legend.
Coming off almost daily variations of getting spat on and insulted by Kallipolins whose rations I'm charged with overseeing, I think at first he's joking. When I realize he isn't, my eyes prickle. Griff notices.
Sorry. I didn't realize that would upset you.
No, it's not that. People don't really rally around me in Kallipolis. Griff's eyes go wide.
But you're everything the revolution promised.
His excitement is so great, so perfectly reminiscent of a press release from the Ministry of Propaganda, that I hear myself laugh. Then my thoughts go to a woman heckling me in a windswept square, to the passy and their leaflets, to the map of our granaries displayed on ragged paper. A menu of potential violence printed by my friends. Power crumpling it in his fist. We have to do something. Maybe once. Now. I'm the one in charge of the enforcing.
21. Comrade in arms. Griff. I should know better. I should know it won't last. But the problem is, happiness brings on a fugue state. You can't remember what came before, and you can't imagine what will come after. Like a sunlit day between weeks of rain, you find it hard to believe, looking up at the sky, that it could ever not be filled with light. I've grown up knowing winter is a time when hunger bites harder. The cold in your bones can't be got out, and every time a loved one coughs, you pray it won't turn to fever. But this winter, everything seems to be going right. Mornings serving Ixion, and rarely training in the air, because the snow and the winds bite too fiercely on most days to spar the dragons. Staring at the papers he carelessly passes me and sends me to deliver, watching the symbols become letters I recognize, and the letters become sounds, and the sounds become words. Nowhere near fast enough, but soon. Soon I'll have information worthy of Antigone. He writes to the Basileian princess often, and her replies come as swift as the trade ships on the passage from Vask will allow. I try to find the words to tell the others, Aga and Granda, and most of all, the other humble riders. But every time I try to tell them, the madness of it, Antigone in the dead of night and Sparker's key warm on my hand, sticks my tongue. I don't know how to tell them. And always, when I imagine us turning on our lords, I imagine Dilo. To the point where every time Antigone arrives at the dunes and apologizes for not yet having Drachthanasia, I feel relieved. Because everything, the nights with Antigone, the days harboring secrets in my chest, pale in comparison to the stolen hours between when I've begun to go to him. Parts of it are exactly as I remember it was with her. Quiet walks through dark corridors, the pressure of our held breaths as I cross the threshold, the silence of it. A bed so deep and soft it's something to drown in, warm with a lover's body, blankets glimmering in the firelight. But the rest of it is entirely different. The way with Dilo, I want it so badly that even in the moment I want more. The way, in so many small things, he gives where Julia only took. I feel as though, with every touch and kiss and breath, I am relearning something I've learned wrong. The absurdity of it is that he thinks he's the one who doesn't know. I don't know. If this was how she didn't. There are so many things to talk about. Always whispering, as if the stone walls might hear us. Memories to examine, worlds of things to say that we've been holding in for years. Training, and Ixion, and even Julia. Do you remember the day she beat Ixion for first rider? I'll never forget it. The look on his face. I'm grinning just thinking about it, though in the dark, D'Lo can't see that. I miss her, he admits. The memories shift around me. Julia the friend, Julia the lover, Julia the leader who feared nothing and listened to no one, unless she felt like it. I miss her too. When talk turns to that day, long awaited by the Dragonborn, when Kallipolis is regained, we talk about it as we always have. We talk about what we look forward to most. I'm looking forward to returning to the Skyfish Summer Palace, D'Lo decides. It's beautiful. And never this cold, so far south. I'll take you there. What about you? It's so strange to be able to switch between these forking visions so easily. The one Antigone and I discuss late at night, where the Dragonborn of New Pythos are brought to their knees, and the one D'Lo and I have grown up being told about. I slide from the first into the second and answer automatically. My family being rewarded. I don't think anything of saying it, but D'Lo swallows and is silent for minutes afterward. Because the one thing we don't talk about, never talk about, is the night D'Lo rescued Garrett and Becca and gave me Sparka's key. He never asks what I've been doing with it, and I never tell him. Though sometimes I wish I could tell him, not about the conspiracy or about Antigone, but about the simple wonder that I've begun to read. I had not known, until I began to spend time in his chambers, how much of D'Lo's time is spent in study. His desk overflows with books and old scrolls from Rhadamanthus's collection, and often I wake to find him working at it. What are you reading? I ask. Oh, I didn't realize you were awake. It's just a bit of old poetry. He says it carefully, with disinterest, and climbs back into bed with me. But a little later, when he goes to the washroom, I roll out of bed and look again at the open volume. It's still hard to read without sounding aloud, but slowly I decipher the section. Let a single urn contain our ashes. My comrade in arms, my friend, my beloved. So that not even our bones lie apart from one another. When you follow me from this world to the next. As I understand, my throat constricts. D'Lo was reading this privately to himself, after being with me. It's from the Aurelian cycle, D'Lo says behind me, about Uriel and his lover. He's emerged from the washroom and is watching me as he towels his face dry. I didn't know he had one. D'Lo nods, and then he drops the towel to the floor, picks up the book, and sits beside me on the bed. He begins to read aloud the section I was just so careful to read silently to myself. Listening to him, I feel a kind of pressure on my heart, as if suddenly there is no space to contain it. His voice catches, uneven on the word, beloved. What happened to them? I ask, hearing the roughness of my voice betray me. Did they end happily? D'Lo lifts a shoulder, turning away to set the book aside. He lays a ribbon down the page. No, but they did get buried together. Fat lot of good that did either of them, I say without thinking. D'Lo lets out a laugh of surprise. It's just a poem, Griff, he says. But there's something in his voice, private and restrained, that makes me know it will never be just a poem to him. Was he a peasant? I don't know why I have to ask that. And when Dilo hesitates, I wish I hadn't. No, he was another Dragon Lord, back before the Aurelians had to flee Orios. The two of them rode together, fought together, and loved. And loved. But they were dragonborn, both. For all the ways I don't fit such a story, Dilo still looking at me, his voice still caught on the word beloved. He still read it in the middle of a night he spent with me. The words are on the tip of my tongue. I can read the poems too. I've been learning. Let me share everything with you as these lovers did. But a lifetime of survival instincts taught me better. Dilo defied his world to give me that key. It was a gesture made across a chasm. He reached across because he didn't have it in him to leap. That reaching was enough to change everything. But I still know better than to ask for more. Dilo was ready to help me, but he isn't ready to look at what that would mean for his people or mine. And as much as I dream of sharing my own vision of the future with him, as much as I wonder in my peaceful moments if maybe he would see not only the beauty but the rightness of it, my people freed, his overthrown, I know these are the musings of a love-struck fool. So maybe I'm not ready either. And so instead of telling him the truth, I pull him closer, and Dilo sets the poem aside. The next night, by our campfire, Antigone opens a new book. This is the revolutionary manifesto of Atreus Athanatos, she says. I think you're ready to read it. I'm sounding out the words, one painful syllable at a time, when a whole sentence comes out. For too long have dragons oppressed our people. A chill goes down my spine, at the words, at the fact that I read them. Antigone, seated beside me, seems to be holding her breath. For too long have we slaved under the Dragon Lord's yoke. For too long has the Triarchy feasted while its people starved. A new order is needed. A new world is called for. And the old one must be destroyed. I think of how Dilo felt, warm in my arms, of the words he read to me with a shaking voice. My comrade in arms. My friend. My beloved. Annie. Tell me what happened in the Red Month. She sounds surprised. They didn't tell you? I want to hear your version. The Dragon Lords were separated from their dragons. Their dragons were poisoned, and the three families were slaughtered down to the last man, woman, and child. It's no different, her version and theirs. But when she says it, it's with a hush of awe rather than the choke of horror. For her, it was the beginning, not the end. And it's a beginning she envisions for me. I look down once more at the revolutionary manifesto, think of Dilo, and feel the ground tilt. I close the usurper's book and hand it to her. I should be heading back. I ride through the night with her words stuck in my head like a refrain, down to the last man, woman, and child. When I land in the Citadel, I reattach Sparker's lead and go, not home to bed, but through the corridors that take me to the Skyfish apartments. For the first time ever, I forget to press my ear against the door first, and for the first time ever, when it opens, Dilo isn't alone. His brother and sister are with him, sitting around his desk with mugs of tea between them, gathered around what looks like some sort of map. Ethelo is laughing at something Fame said. They fall silent at the sight of me in the doorway. Griff, Dilo says blankly. Fame's thick black hair, down from its usual braids, forms a cloud around her head. She taps a finger into it as her eyes narrow on me, then they turn to Ethelo with a roll. They're twins, miniature, lankier versions of Dilo, 3 years younger than us. Told you, Fame tells Ethelo. Ethelo is a passus, forsaken by dragons, and it leaves him prone to joking about himself and about others. He wolf whistles at Dilo as he gets to its feet. We've been waiting on this one for years, brother. He lifts a mug of tea as if in toast and bows with a flourish. Heartfelt congratulations to you both. Out, says Dilo. Fami seizes Ethelo's arm. Oh, we're leaving. We're leaving you to it. With a shriek of laughter, she pulls her twin from the room, and it echoes tinnily in their wake. For a moment, we both stand frozen. Dilo recovers first. I should probably go after them. Ask them not to talk. But with Ethelo and Fami, that's next to impossible. They're chatty with Roxana, and Roxana is chatty with everybody. Yeah. I'll be right back. He leaves. I go to the desk, look down at the map. No, not a map. A plan of a city. Of Kallipolis. With certain buildings marked. The headline is in Kalish script, but beneath it, Dilo has transcribed the dragon tongue translation of each word. And it's his hand that I study, deciphering. Granary locations of Kallipolis. I stare at it. The door behind me creaks open and I jump. They're a nightmare, Dilo grimaces, then looks past me at the blueprint I'm staring at. What is this? I ask him. Information about Kallipolis. Father asked us to plan an airstrike. On these places? Dilo nods. What are they? He hesitates. Armories. I stare at him, and then, instead of keeping my mouth shut like I ought to do, I open it. No, they're not. Dilo stares at me. I place a finger on the word granary. Dilo looks from it to me and back again. I see, he says. That's all. And then he begins to roll up the plan. Suddenly, he looks exhausted. He turns away before adding, You're still in your flame suit. The twins noticed. The day after my conversation with Dilo, Ixion asks me to serve at a private party he's having with the other Dragonborn riders. It's in his apartments, which gets my alarm up, but it's not until I